Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you. Welcome to our premier edition of Focus on Al-Islam in America, featuring Imam Waris Deen Muhammad, the leader of the American Muslim Mission. In our premier edition of Focus on Al-Islam, we will attempt to not only educate, but also to inspire. The goals of all of our shows are to bring to light many of the issues that face the American people, and to show how this universal religion, the religion of Al-Islam, not only deals with the problem, but also challenges many of the hidden problems that are not seen, and elevates man to the level that Allah had intended for him. We seek in our programs to inspire our audience, to deal with many of the problems that face their families, that face them in their economic situations, that face them in their home life, that face them in their work situation. There will be many things that we will deal with in the next few weeks that will challenge the thinking of the contemporary attitudes of the American culture. We pray that you're receptive, but most importantly, we pray that you come to our programs with a sincere heart. In our program today, we're going to be interviewing one of the most knowledgeable men on Al-Islam in the world, Imam Waris Deen Muhammad. In our discussions today, we're going to focus on some of the economic problems that we are challenged with in America. We pray that you stay tuned. Right now, we're going to break for a quick commercial, and we will be right back with, once again, Focus on Al-Islam in America. But also, when we return, we'll be dealing with some of the central issues that relate directly to how we're going to solve those economic problems. The economic problems that we face here in America are threefold. They not only have a present situation, but they also have a root cause. And if we don't deal with the root cause, we'll also be confronted with a future that will be extremely dismal. With this, we're going to go after the root of the economic problems that face America. And as you know, whatever faces America faces the world. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back in another few minutes. Thank you, and peace be unto you. Assalamu alaikum, peace be unto you, and welcome back to Focus on Al-Islam in America. We're very honored today to have with us one of the foremost leaders in the world, and in many individuals' minds, the foremost leader in the world, as it relates to the religion of Al-Islam, Imam Waris Deen Muhammad, the leader of the American Muslim Mission, which in America is the largest identifiable Muslim community. A couple of notes about Imam Waris Deen Muhammad. As we all know, there was a movement, and a tremendous movement, amongst the black community, or so-called African-American community, as relates to the civil rights movement of the 60s. But very few realize that that movement had its roots very early in the 20th century. In the 30s and 40s and 50s, with Imam Waris Deen Muhammad's father, Elijah Muhammad. Imam Waris Deen Muhammad has now taken the reins of what used to be called the Nation of Islam. In the Nation of Islam, when the passing of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad came about in 1975, the world was astonished to find such a smooth transition between one leader that had captivated the masses and another leader. With us today, we're going to interview this great leader of our time and ask him some questions relating to some of the economic conditions that we face here in America and try to attack some of the solutions that confront us, that seem to perplex all the scholars. Imam Waris Deen Muhammad, I'd like to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And just as we go right into the meat of the show, I'd like to just ask you a brief question, and as it relates to the religion itself, the religion of Al-Islam. It seems to be such a unique force. It seems to include almost everything. There seems to be so much, a tremendous cohesiveness about the religion that not only encompasses new converts, but encompasses the world as it relates to different cultures, different ethnic groups, different countries.
Yes, that's
can
true.
Can you explain why that is?
Yes. We often speak of our religion as being a comprehensive religion. We know that religion means a certain orientation that includes the worship of God, worship of one God, our God, and behavior, rules of behavior for the people. And that when we think of religion, we think of spiritual life. But with Al-Islam, it's not that way at all. When we think of Al-Islam, we think of an all-inclusive way of life. We think of emphasis being as strongly on the material needs as on the spiritual needs.
Hmm. Brother Imam, I must say that in our community there are many, many very pressing economic issues, and we're going to try to attack those economic issues from the Islamic standpoint. Al-Islam purports to be able to solve all the ills of mankind, so I'm assuming that in that is also the economic problem that man faces.
Well, certainly. yeah, one statement in Quran, in our holy book, and really that's the nucleus of the Muslim life, his holy book, the Quran. And Prophet Muhammad, between the Quran and Prophet Muhammad, we can see the whole life of a Muslim. You know, the Quran is the word of God, and it has its place in the life of the people. And Prophet Muhammad, he has a specific role as a messenger of God, as God's prophet, and he plays a he has a definite place in the life of the people. But there is a statement in the Quran that says, "Seek the hereafter with means that God has veiled you. However, don't forget your share in the material world." And I often quote that from Quran because to me that's what we need to know to keep the balance in life, so we don't go verge off too far on the spiritual side and neglect the material development.
In America, African Americans, so-called African Americans, Black Americans, we've been in this country for, I guess, a good 400 years or so. But it seems that when you compare our economic development with those of other minorities that have not been here nearly as long, it seems as if we're eclipsed by their advancement. It seems as if almost we've been held back. We're not making the kind of achievements economically and business and finance and real estate, whatever you name, it doesn't seem we're making the same kind of advancements. Why is that?
And different educators and sociologists, they have had something to say about that problem, you know. And I find that those who have identified it as a problem where most of the people are just contained in, I would say, a kind of situation. And they are not really contained by or established upon idea that directs their life. You know, Christianity, the church, has had a major role in the life of the African-American people. And Christianity directs you to be good. Christianity directs you to be Christ-like, you know. But I think most of us interpret that to mean be good, you know. So we don't see a direction for our whole life. We just see a situation, our condition, that I should conform to that condition. I should be good. That's a condition. Good is a condition. We need a direction. Our religion, Islam, or Islam is commonly called, is different because it does not only tell you to be good, it tells you that you have to follow direction, that your life has to have direction. And I think that accounts for it more than anything else. And I believe certain writers, like the writer who put out the book Black Bourgeoisie, he mentioned the role of the church in the black man's life, you know, in America, and how the church has been a major institution, but it has, in a way, failed the hopes and aspirations of the African-American people.
Right.
Yes, because it has put too much emphasis on the by and by life, and not enough emphasis on the here and now life.
I was going to ask you that question later on. It seems that there are so many churches, almost on two and three in some cases, on every street corner. It would seem that there should be more development if for all the churches that we have in the
African area. Sure, you think so. In Chicago, you know, we have the neighborhood I came up in. We came up in similar kind of environment. And I recall the street just two blocks from us to the west, State Street is the main artery. And you found what was dominant there was taverns and churches.
Hmm.
In one block, you find maybe four or five taverns and about four or five churches.
Sounds like Harlem.
Yes, well, that's State Street, South Side Chicago at that time, you know. Before urban renewal came in, it's different now. Expressway had knocked all that out and pushed that street somewhere else now.
Hmm.
I think that what it is a desperate attempt on the part of religious leaders, the church leaders, to treat the ills of the poor down and out person, you know? And I think that's why they say, well, we got all this crime, we have to be there too. We got all these social kind of sickening things, prostitute houses and taverns and et cetera. So we have to be there too. So the medicine man is trying to keep up with the sick. But what I think sometimes is the medicine man doesn't realize that he perhaps is finding a market.
Mm.
And that's what we have to worry about.
Mm. Related directly to that, are there any psychological scars, historical psychological scars, that impede the development of the minority communities? Relating right back to the church, are there any some kind of historical?
Well, certainly, I believe that the whole experience of slavery, especially if we see slavery really as an economic system, slavery was an economic system, and the whole way that the slave related to work, to the material world and work, was negative. Because all of his labor and energy was really enriching his master, not himself. His condition didn't change, no matter how much he did for his master. So it really gave us a bad experience with material involvement.
Hmm. So we have to begin, if we're going to address the economic conditions of African Americans here in the United States, we have to, in fact, go back to a historical development that has affected their thinking, which brings us up to now.
Certainly, I believe it's a need for the religious people and civic leaders who are trying to advance or trying to pull us out of the slump, you know. I think there's need for them, for us, to really do some study, do some research and study the psychological developments for the slave during those centuries. No slavery.
And so you're saying we can't really rise above our condition unless we go back in time and really deal with those things?
Yes, I believe.
Or can we shortstop that and just kind of start from where we are now?
No, psychologically, many of us are held back because we have the wrong approach to material development. We want something quick and something exciting just to, like putting a Band-Aid on the wound or just like getting a good charge, you know, and it's quick and quick and passing. But we need a far-reaching view on life and material demands on life. We need to get that spirit of the pioneers, you know, they're doing something for the future, doing something for future generations. Mm-hmm. And in order for that to come about, we can't have people with that kind of sensitivity toward material things that no matter what I do, it won't enrich me.
Fascinating. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to return to this discussion. I think it's also fascinating to note that there are some long-standing scars and issues that we need to address. In our next segment, we're going to address some of those long-standing scars and psychological marks on the mentality of African Americans. And we're also going to begin to address some of the immediate concerns that face us here in America. Stay tuned. And we'll be right back.
Mm-hmm.
Peace be unto you, assalamu alaikum, and welcome back to Focus on Al-Islam in America. We've been interviewing Imam Warifuddin Muhammad, the leader of the American Muslim Mission on economic development. Right now we're going to jump right back into our questions. And Brother Imam, I'd like to address a question along the same lines as the others, but trying to go, once again, going back at the root. We talked about economic conditions. Are all of our problems as a community strictly attributable to economic conditions, or are there social and moral factors involved in the scheme?
Definitely there are social and moral factors. In fact, these are very important. The social factors, I think, perhaps are the most basic, because after all, when we think of morality, proper morality, we have to see that in some kind of setting where we are interacting with other people, because I don't think of what is morally right or what is morally wrong until I think of other people, something outside of me. So I do see the social and moral factors as being more important than really the economic factors. That is, for us to get right, for getting a right grip on life. The challenge is to get a grip on life and to go right directly to the material exploits before knowing what are the real needs. By social, we mean human needs, people needs.
I see.
People living in a group and having to share with each other and having to relate to each other. Those social needs are really the basis for all other expressions. Even our moral expressions are expressions of that. Our economic expressions are expressions of that need, that essential need.
Is that right? The moral, you know, they're actually expressions of
certainly,
the social? Is
certainly.
That
right? And I find it really beneficial, I find it helpful for me to always think of moral life as the expression of intelligence, as an intelligence, a need for intelligence to express itself in a certain vein. Are in a certain kind of setting or relationship. If we think of morality as just being a good choice or something like that, and don't see that it has grown of necessity out of the social pattern of life, then we will treat morals lightly. Morals can't be treated lightly. And people who think of morals as just as being good for God's sake, or being good for mama's sake, you know, or for daddy's sake, you know. And people who think of morals in that sense, they really have morals out of touch with the original base or original rock bed of morality.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Now, staying with that moral question right now, what is it about the religion of Al-Islam and the moral kind of dynamic that's happening in the religion of Al-Islam that is somehow different from the kind of dynamic that's happening in Christianity that would make Al-Islam more appropriate for dealing with that issue than traditional Christianity as it's been practiced here in the West?
Well, I would say Muslims, they are not so, we are morally conscious people, certainly we are, and the moral idea plays a major role in our life, that's true. But I think perhaps Muslims, because of the comprehensive kind of idea that they have as religion, that is the broad application of their religion to all needs in the society rather than stressing just the spiritual side.
Mm-hmm.
I think because of that, perhaps our moral vision is perhaps more in touch with social life. For example, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, the late leader of the Nation of Islam, as it was called, Honorable Elijah Muhammad, he taught morals that covered almost everything, and that's Islamic. You know, the brother, when he thought of morality, he didn't just think of using the tongue in a very decent way, but he thought of his clothing, keeping his clothing clean. He thought of the responsibility that he had to operate a clean business, you know.
Mm.
So the morals is more ethic and concept ethics and concept
than just the culture.
You're right, that's right. It includes the whole culture. And I believe that's perhaps what Muslims, I won't say all Muslims as compared with Christians, because I find that Christians don't conform to any one pattern. I find Christians in poor neighborhoods, neglected neighborhoods, they conform to one pattern. Then I find Christians in different, better neighborhoods conforming to a different pattern.
The tears even there.
Yeah, and perhaps that's true for Muslims too. But one thing we do have, I think, going for us that's very good, and that is that our moral concept is not limited to just emotional kinds of stirrings in man, but it applies to all the needs in the society.
Because on that note, there are some that say that Islam was good and practical for possibly the Saudi Arabians 1,400 years ago, but we're living in America now. There are different kinds of social conditions. There are tremendous, you know, complex economic problems. There are all kinds of developments that were not in Saudi Arabia at the time of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. So that, oh, Islam was good then, but now you need, maybe you don't need so much religion, Islam at least. Is this not suited for the time? How would you respond to those that come from that point of view?
Well, let me ask permission to handle it a different way. you know, I'm not sure, perhaps it was Mark Twain, it could have been Shakespeare, Mark Twain, who said that East is East and West is West, and never will the twain meet, you know. Well, maybe they won't meet, but I think now is the time for them to cross, if not meet, you know. And I believe that the West now has what the East needs. We talk about industry, technology, industry, okay? But I think the West now needs to go to the East for the revival of Christianity, for the revival of the religion. Not that we're advocating that we send ministers, Christian ministers, over to the East for courses in religion. No, indeed. But to go back there and look at the sentiments that America has lost, that most of the Americans living in the great metropolitan areas have lost. Those moral sentiments and religious sentiments need to come back.
Definitely. On the political end of things, relating, still staying on the course here, what would you say then is the politician's role in our communities and helping us deal with these economic problems? Do we have any responsibility that we need to kind of buckle them into that would help on these problems that we face? So,
well, certainly, we have some good, very good politicians. Some I don't care to name because I think perhaps they wouldn't like for me to identify them as politicians, but they are politicians, and they are working with people in their communities. They are trying to help people get out of their economic straits, economic strain that they're in, you see. And these are political leaders that I think are really worthwhile in the light of what the circumstances are, the economic circumstances are now. I think that politicians should be always serving the urgent needs in his public, in his constituents. He should be serving those urgent needs, and he shouldn't wait until election to try to win their support by attacking something that he knows their sentiments are already against, you know, and to get in their support. There's a demagogue, and then there's a true political leader, right? So I see too many of our political leaders as demagogues. They just watch the people to see which way their sentiments are going. And then when they want to run, they start appealing to the tendency that's already in the people, you know. And naturally, if you're going my way, I say, hey, welcome, man, you know. So that's what I see as a major problem. Then we have the politician that I think is the example of a good politician, what the politician really should be about. And he's all the year round watching developments in his neighborhood, in his community. And he's fighting bad influences in his community. And he's educating and informing his community so that his community will be able to make wise choices. when election time comes.
Because it seems that our communities need a whole lot of good politicians like that, because we have a lot of politicians that come through. In fact, we're in an election period right now. And many of these politicians who are coming in for re-election, we haven't seen for the past 2 years. But it seems they're coming back now, like they do every two years or so, you know, trying to come after the people to get their vote. But the condition that they're supposed to be dealing with never changes. And they're the same politician who's always coming back, but nothing changes in some of those communities.
Yes, and I believe that that's true mainly for communities that are stagnant, communities that are not progressive, communities that don't have economic base or economic substance. Because the more you get involved in productivity, doing something, the more you have to invest. You invest your time, you invest your money, and what you involve in become more precious for you, more dear to you. Your roots are going deeper. And then, you know, you can't tolerate a man who's just coming here and talking about superficial things, you know. Mm-hmm. A politician can't come and just address you on superficial issues and satisfy you, because you have establishment here, and you have things that you have given your blood to, and your time, and your sweat is all invested there, you know. So you can't accept that a politician come in and just address the sentiments of the community. You say, well, hey, well, what about business, man? Well, what are you going to do for our business? How are you going to stimulate business? Say, hey, man, well, what about the health problems we have in this neighborhood, you know? We have to go to work, man. I got to have good health, you know. So you begin to address issues that are more significant, that are more meaningful. And then that puts the pressure on that kind of politician, you see. So he has to go out and campaign somewhere else, find him a new neighborhood, a new town, or he has to get real, he has to become real.
Mm-hmm. You know, it seems that in our communities also, that we have some brilliant men that appear to come up and get groomed in our communities, but when they go downtown and they come uptown, they're a different human being.
Yeah.
What happens to some of our politicians when they go downtown? And it seems like they change places.
I think they didn't get the right kind of training before going downtown.
Mm-hmm.
Before going downtown, they have to stand by themselves. They have to just lock the door in the apartment, close themselves into the apartment, you know. Then they have to do a lot of research and study the history of politics, the history of societies, the growth of cities, the growth of nations, and really get a good grip on what this is all about. And put a picture of whoever's downtown on the wall. If it's the mayor, whoever it is, put it on the wall. And look it straight in the eye and say, now I got what you got. And we're going to work this town together.
That's how we go after respect.
Yes. Right.
Wonderful. Brother Emanuel, we're going to try to pull up in a second, but I would like to ask you one quick question. And that as it relates to what kind of goal should we establish in our communities in terms of a level of achievement?
I think first of all, we have to look at the needs, the most urgent needs. And for most of our community, the most urgent need, and I know I sound philosophical all the time, but that's what it is. The most urgent need is for a philosophy of life, you know. We don't have that no more. We need a philosophy of life. We need a philosophy of life that will direct us and keep our life consistent and keep us going for higher and higher objectives, you see. Something that won't be exhausted over a few months, but something that's designed to carry us for generations and generations and never become exhausted. So really I think what's needed is a philosophy, a way of seeing life, a way of interpreting life, a way of interpreting man's role, his needs. That's what's needed most.
Wonderful. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for viewing. We're not going any place for any length of time. What we're going to do, we're going to break for a commercial. And before we do, we'd like to thank many of the sponsors that you will be seeing throughout the program. Without their support, we would not be able to make the show possible. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Hey, ma'am. Wallace Edin Muhammad. Before we go right into our questions, I would like to note that Imam Wallace Muhammad has a book that is available for sale. The book is called As the Light Shineth from the East. It's available at all the mosques throughout the country. Ladies and gentlemen, I've gone through this book and I found it to be one of the most phenomenal pieces of literature that I've read in recent years. It deals with many of the same issues that we are addressing on this program. We're going to go right into the program and ask Iman Waqfi Muhammad a couple of questions as relates to a phenomenon in the minority communities, which is the Korean businessman. In the last couple of years, we've had a number of brothers and sisters from Korea who come into our community. Who have taken over existing businesses or who have in many cases gone into empty shops and set out the shingles. And right now doing very, very well, so it appears. The interesting thing is that there appears to be a number of complaints from the larger communities that they're setting up shop in, the minority communities. Some are saying that they come in, they do very well, and they take the money out of the communities. Yeah. Others appear to be resentful just because they're not of the same ethnic group. How do you deal with that? How do you respond to that? What do you identify as being the situation there?
If I was the mayor, I would want to see those empty places being productive, bringing in some income, if we can't stimulate the people who are there first to operate jobs, to bring in some income, then I'm sure if I was the mayor, I might dislike it. I might say, oh boy, now here they come, the Koreans are coming in. I wish that the black community would have gotten in there and taken advantage of that opportunity, but they didn't, and now the Koreans are there. Life, Brother Suleiman, I see life as functioning spiritually in the home or for the individual. And then as we grow, we have to grow. We have needs. Somebody has to bring the chicken, you know. We have needs. We have to eat, you know. We have to be clothed. So life then has to go out from the individual kind of security to a community kind of security. And the more we get involved in trying to produce or supply our own needs, the more we get involved in community security and community growth. And I think the problem with most of us, and this is something too that I think we have inherited, or something that has lingered from slave days, you know, and the terrible kind of consequences that occurred after slavery for us to set us back materially. I believe that we have just become kind of disattached, unattached. We are not attached to the community, essential community life. Whereas a Korean who lived in Korea, most likely he was attached to the community life. We see the community life in its institutions. Its institutions of learning, its institutions of business, and etc. All of these institutions represent the essential life of a community. And if black people are not tied into those institutions, then they won't have no community strength. There will be no community strength. So the more we develop, the more we attach ourselves to the essential institutions that sustain a community, the more involvement we'll have in it, and the more progress we'll see ourselves making. I think that community orientation, that community attachment is what's needed. And perhaps that's what we have going for us as Muslims. Our life is called community, ummah, our community, you see. And this concept of our life as a community life that requires to have school, requires to have a mosque for worship and religious studies, but it requires to have a school also to educate our children. Prophet Muhammad said education is a must for every male and female. That was 1400 years ago, long before public education was brought about, and and everybody's obligated to go to school. Girls and boys have to go to school now, you know. But 1,400 years ago, Prophet Muhammad made that a must, that every child be educated, whether it's male or female. And these institutions are very necessary, but what? How come we need a school? We needed a school because somebody needed some food first, and he needed some wood to build him a shelter. So he went out to find food, he went out to find materials for a shelter, and in time he developed skills at doing that. And then he needed to leave that to his posterity, his coming generation, so he established a school, you see. So we need to see the whole community life in its historical perspective, and see that the individual just doesn't have any hope unless he really attach himself to community, vital community programs that we see really reflected, represented in our institutions. The institution, business institution, learning institutions, cultural institutions, all of these are very essential institutions. And until we really see these things as precious, as sacred, we should look upon them with sacred respect. We should go to business like we go to the church, you know, because God requires that we feed. Didn't Jesus say in the New Testament, feed the people? And he held the leaders accountable for feeding the poor. You know, we know this applies spiritually as well as materially, but it didn't say. It was talking about food, you know. So is there any bread? Is there any fish, you know? They wanted some food. So these material needs, respect for them, and respect for work, honest work, is sacred with us. Respect for education is sacred with the Muslim. Respect for honest work is sacred with the Muslim. Until we bring this kind of sense of community life back to the African-American people, I think we're going to continue to see these places remain empty shells until somebody comes from abroad and revive them again.
So it's the institutions that are the concern that we would have to grow toward.
Certainly. In a recent television appearance, the new leader of the Urban League, the new national leader, he mentioned something. And he addressed what this we're talking about now. He says that the new organizations and the leaders have to really be about raising the functional ability of the people. And by functional ability, that's just we function as individuals, but we have to function with each other in a social context. And to do that, we have to raise the level of performance in the individuals that belong to these neighborhoods. And that performance is not only spiritual. You'll die if you don't do something materially.
Mm-hmm. On that level, you mentioned something about the individual. And one of the things that I guess happened within the last, the last 20 years is that we've developed a lot of very talented, very educated African-Americans, so-called black folk.
Oh, yes.
They're in major corporations. They're doctors. They're lawyers. They're PhDs. They're... You name it, we have it in terms of professionalism.
I know, right, and we're very proud of that. But what we're missing is an effort on the part of skilled, talented, well-educated people to change the character of the African-American community.
What pulls them away, though? Why is it that they don't come back?
Professional opportunities. We need charity. They need to see the need at home. Go back to the neighborhood you came from and address the issues there and do some of the poor life up there. That's what we need more of. And we can't do it alone. We're a religious movement, you know, and we have some very talented people in our community. I'm looking at one now.
Don't point at me.
We have some very professional people and very talented people. But we can't do it all. If we could
just
get more,
they leave.
It's a great disappointment. And I tell the people in our community, look, you were born in this community, you went to school, the Clare Muhammad School. I said, okay, we gave you something, you know. You survived here long enough to get started, wherever you're going, to Kodiak or wherever you're going, you know. And don't forget us. And come back here and inspire youngsters that's coming up like you came up. And make a contribution. At home base, you know, we have to do that. All of us, we want to encourage people to go out and to progress and to advance themselves, but find time to come back home and say a kind word or an encouraging word to the people back home that helps you get where you're going.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. On education, one thing thing I think I heard in one of your lectures a while back is that the Malawian child or the black child, the African-American child, all the same, will go into a school and sit by a Caucasian, but for some reason, the Caucasian will react one way to their education, and the African-American, the so-called black American, will react another way. And where the Caucasian will build great things and do great things, for some reason, once again, the African-American will only go so far. It seems like there's at a certain point, an automatic shut-off. I'm not quoting you directly, but I'm trying to get the feeling what you're saying. And that was fascinating because it seems that more and more of our people move toward busing just to get next to those who...
Yeah, I was in junior college in Chicago, you know, and all of my education came from the Muslim school. It was called University of Islam in those days, but it was just an elementary and secondary school. So I went to take some courses, English and English, at junior college in Chicago. And I noticed that most of the African Americans, they would sit back from the front seats. They wouldn't go up to the front seats. They would sit as back as, half of them would sit back as far as they could, it seemed. And others would sit maybe in the middle. Very seldom would you see an African American go up and take the front seat in the class, you see. So I've always been shy. In the Muslim school, I was shy. And I like to hear, though, because I don't want to miss the knowledge. I don't want to be on the spot, but I don't want to miss the knowledge. So I was sitting maybe two rows or three rows back, you know. I didn't want to be on the first row. So I went to junior college in Chicago, Lutheran Junior College. I went up toward the front, you know, and I wanted my second or third row place. And then it came dawn on me that most of African, my ethnic group, the African American, they were sitting back, you know, way back. I thought they were sitting way back. And I think what's happening, there's an exception though. You find a black, he comes and he sits right on the front line, you know, and he's ready to get into it. He's ready to get into it. You engage the professor and anybody else, you know. So you find but that's the exception. It's a rare exception. And I think what it is, what we were talking about earlier in some of the earlier things that we've said on this program, we have a psychological block, you know. We are hung up with certain sensitivities of the white folks, you know. When you sit with them in school, unconsciously, I think, we are saying, yeah, you think you're better than me because this is your thing, you know, because your people built this school, because your people wrote these books, because your people outlined these courses, you think you're better than me, you know. And you might not know it. Maybe some black has some part in it too, you know. It might not have been that big, but some part, maybe some very real part in outlining the course even, you know. But all he sees is the white presence. The white presence is overwhelming here in America. It just overwhelms the average person, the white presence. And I think that's what makes some of us step back, or some of us take negative attitudes when we come out to compete with all of Americans. I don't see myself as competing with white people anymore. I see myself as competing with challenges. Mm. And I don't care if it's white, black, green, or red, it's a challenge, I'm going to compete with it. And I think I can do whatever, I can meet the opposition. Mm. I can meet the test. And that's the spirit we have to have. So what we have to do first is like I said, for the politician, the average child, he has to step back and get a grip on his life first. And say, look, the man looks less like me. Now, I might can't out-talk him, but maybe I can out-run him. Maybe I can beat him doing something, and give me enough time, maybe I can beat him doing talking too, you know, whatever it is. Now, we all must have come into the world just alike, and he didn't have a grip on this. He's gotten ahead of us. Okay, so you have to see that life in its reality, and see that everybody start off the same. Just some people stay at it long, get into it first, and get ahead of everybody else, you know, and just say, well, this math is not the white man's math. This math is math. This was derived out of the material world. This is how he derived this concept, from the material world. This is not white. This is earth. This is not white. This is universe. And say that for every other science and for every other course, and just go in there seeing nothing is white, not racially speaking. Everything is material, and everything is of the world. Everything has scientific place in this universal reality, and God put it there, and I can get it out just as easy as the white man. Just give me enough time.
Wonderful. I
I'm afraid that we run out of time, Imam Muhammad.
Well, it's been a real joy. And I pray that you, the audience, will join us for our second part next week, where we also go into economic development, where we take it to another level. One of the things that we try to do, or focus on Al-Islam in America, is, as we said earlier, to educate the viewer, to inspire him, and also to show him a context of living in the scope of the religion of Al-Islam. To do this, we bring the foremost thinkers on the religion in the world. We've been fortunate today to have the leader of the American Muslim Mission, Imam Waraq B. Muhammad. We pray that you enjoyed our program, and we pray that you also join us for part two of Focus on Al-Islam in America. Once again, thank you for joining us. And we also thank our sponsors, because without them, this program would not be made possible. I greet you. As-salamu alaykum.